one God to the exclusion of all others, who are seen, nonetheless, to be gods. That is the term I have already used and will continue to use, henotheism. I will contend that the growing popularity of henotheism in the empire paved the way for the Christian declaration that there is in fact only one God and he alone should be worshipped. Traditional Jews had long insisted on worshipping only their own ancestral God. As far as many were concerned, the pagan gods were not gods at all. Scholars have often maintained that the popularity of Judaism in the empire made the Christian mission possible. The pagans were widely attracted to the Jewish notion of one God, to the stress in Judaism on weekly fellowship, community, and sense of belonging as part of the worship, and to the strict code of ethics in the Jewish tradition. There may indeed be an element of truth in this claim, but a major caveat is necessary. The idea that Judaism was widely seen as attractive may be overly romantic. It is true that Jews did attract some outsiders into their ranks. That was the case with most cults, however, including the sundry mystery religions. On the whole, though, unlike most of the mystery religions, Judaism was looked upon with real suspicion in the empire. Jews were often thought of as superstitious and very strange indeed, even repugnant. They practiced circumcision. You do what to your baby boys? They refrained from perfectly good foods. They refused to put in a full week of work, and they kept to themselves and did not interact with the greater society, for example, at civic festivals. But it may be that precisely these perceived oddities were what made Christianity more acceptable than Judaism to the wider populace. Most Christians from Gentile stock did not practice circumcision, keep kosher, or observe the Sabbath. They did, however, stress the worship of one God, high ethical standards, and community. Wasn't this the best of Judaism without its peculiarities? In answering that question, we need to make a special effort not to think that somehow monotheistic faiths are inherently superior and that the movement away from paganism is somehow progress. It is not progress. It is not regress either. I'm not making any evaluative judgment or asking whether one religious system is better than another and closer to some kind of ultimate truth. I am simply asking if a new religion may have proved attractive to those who followed the traditional ways. Scholars have long known of henotheistic tendencies among some ancient philosophers who had come to think that behind all the diversity of the world, above all the manifestations of what we know and experience, there must be one ultimate reality that makes sense of it all. This principle of unity could be understood to be the ultimate divinity. And so those philosophers stressed the oneness at the heart, or at the beginning of all things. The sense of one ultimate divinity could also be found outside the ranks of the professional philosophers, among the non-philosophical, highly religious as well. In an inscription found in the city of Onoanda in southwest Asia Minor, modern Turkey, appears the self-declaration of a god who terms himself a mere angel in comparison with the one ultimate divine being. In response to the question of who or what is God, here is how he describes that one. Born of itself, untaught, without a mother, unshakable, not contained in a name, known by many names, dwelling in fire, this is God. We, his angels, are a small part of God. To you who ask this question about God, what his essential nature is, he has pronounced that Aether is God who sees all, on whom you should gaze and pray at dawn, looking to the sunrise. The ether, that surrounds us all is God, but this God is not simply a material substance. God sees all and deserves universal worship. The other gods are his messengers, the angels, who form part of that greater divinity. This is not a Jewish or Christian text. It is from a pagan. We have seen that pagans might take several paths to arrive at such a concept of divinity. One is hinted at in the inscription, as God is said to be the one of many names. Thus it was sometimes thought that all the names of divine beings were simply alternative designations of the ultimate divine being, who encompassed all the activities of all the gods and the names associated with them. Other pagans would cite all the great attributes of their favorite god. He is the mighty one, the all-knowing one, the great healer, and so on. So much would be attributed to this one that there would be nothing left for anyone else, making that one, in effect, the greatest god there was. Other pagans simply thought there had to be one god who was greatest. By the time of Christianity, other cults proclaimed adherence to the greatest god, whether Sol Invictus, revered by the Emperor Aurelian, then Constantius, and finally Constantine, or instead the god explicitly called Theos Hypsistos, the greatest god. One scholar has proposed an interesting hypothesis concerning the origins of the cult to this latter god by noting that Roman culture and religion were inherently competitive. Members of the aristocracy competed regularly, daily, for higher status, striving for greater position and rank. Cities competed with one another for prominence in their regions. Among other things, cities worked to stage the most lavish and interesting religious festivals to attract crowds from other places. The larger the crowd, and the more glowing the accolades, the greater the sense of civic pride. Cult centers, such as oracles, where people could come to ask questions of a divinity, and answers would be provided by specially appointed priests or priestesses, often in poetic verse, competed with one another for empire-wide attention and recognition. This was a culture, and these were religions, that were all about status, recognition, and prominence. So too with the gods of a city. The city of Ephesus claimed it was the center for the worship of Artemis. The goddess was worshipped there better than anywhere else. She, for them, was the great goddess, greater than all other divinities. The cult of Theos Hypsistos may well have emerged from some such context of competition. This god needed no other name. He was literally the greatest god. He deserved more worship than any other. He is sometimes referred to in inscriptions as the one god. Contrary to what you might think, the declaration that he is one does not mean this god's devotees believed he was the only god. We know this because of the way the term one is used in comparable ancient contexts. For example, if a benefactor to a community was especially generous, giving far more than anyone else had ever given the city, he could be referred to as the one patriot and benefactor. That would not mean that no one else had ever given the city anything. It meant he was uniquely beneficial. Calling any divinity the one god functions the same way. In the words of one scholar, it underlines the uniqueness of one particular god. In no pagan context do we find the claim that there is only one god to the exclusion of all others, but we do find claims that, ultimately, there is one god overall. This is clear not only from ancient inscriptions, hundreds to Theos Hypsistos have been identified and studied, but also from the writings of ancient pagans. Consider a statement made by a devout pagan, Maximus of Madara, written in a letter to the church theologian Augustine near the end of the 4th century. That the forum of our city is occupied by a gathering of savior gods, we see and assert. Who is so insane, so deluded as to deny the utter certainty that there is one highest god, without beginning, without offspring, in nature, like a great and glorious father? We invoke under many names his powers that are diffused through the created world because obviously none of us knows his name. God is the name common to all religions, so it is that while we honor his parts, so to speak, separately with various supplications, we are clearly worshiping him in his entirety. Christians realized that many pagans were drawn to the idea of one ultimate divinity. Some 2 centuries earlier, we have the words of the Christian defender of the faith, Athenagoras of Athens. We, i.e. Christians, are not the only ones who limit God to a single being, since almost all those who have reason to speak about the principles of the world are unanimous, even if unwillingly so, that the divine is singular. Soon thereafter we have the rhetorical question of the Christian apologists Tertullian. Is it not generally held that there is one higher and more potent, as it were the world's chief ruler, endowed with absolute power and majesty? Apology 24. In short, the Christian declaration that there was only one ultimate divinity would not have seemed completely extraordinary among pagans. Most pagans no doubt knew about the Jews in their midst. Jews appear to have numbered in the millions and were widely known and discussed. But even more, the notion of one God over all would have been broadly familiar from both philosophical and religious traditions, attested with growing frequency in the empire. When Christians spoke of this ultimate God, on the other hand, they insisted on two supremely important provisos. Unlike pagan henotheists, they maintained that this God was none other than the God of the Christians. They insisted that anyone who chose to worship him was to do so to the complete exclusion of all other gods. One might think this exclusionary insistence would be off-putting and offensive in a world filled with gods, dooming the Christian mission to failure. On the contrary, it had just the opposite effect. It was this claim that led to the triumph of Christianity. Christianity as a missionary religion. Even if pagans who adhered to one cult or another liked others to join them in their rituals of worship and welcome them when they chose to do so, we have no evidence of organized efforts to make it happen. As a prominent historian of Roman religion, Ramsay McMullen states, of any organized or conscious evangelizing in paganism, there are very few signs indeed. In fact, we don't know of any missionary religions in the pagan world. Not even the mystery religions appear to have employed organized efforts to bring in devotees. It is sometimes said that the expansion of Mithraism presupposes some kind of mission, but that turns out not to be true. The religion spread essentially by word of mouth from friend to friend, family member to family member, at least among adult males. None of that is particularly surprising. What may be far less expected is that ancient Judaism also lacked any genuine missionary impulse. This claim cuts against what scholars had long argued, that the Christian concept of an evangelistic religion had been inherited from the Jews. But more recent scholarship has persuasively shown that this was not the case at all. Of course, Jews typically did welcome anyone who seriously wanted to consider adopting their worship and ways. We do have records of pagans converting to become Jews. Among other things, this meant that converts, if men, were circumcised, and both men and women went through the process of being admitted into the Jewish fold and agreeing to observe established practices of worship and custom. There were other pagans who might be thought of as Jewish sympathizers. These would be Gentiles who chose, for rather obvious reasons, not to be circumcised and possibly not to follow the entire set of prescriptions in Jewish law. But they would have worshipped the God of the Jews and possibly him only in synagogues with Jews, and participated in Jewish life as members of the community with a kind of secondary status. Sometimes these people are called God-fearers because they revered the one God, even if they chose not to adopt certain Jewish identity markers. Nonetheless, there is very little evidence to suggest that Jews actively sought converts or partial converts. Outsiders may have been attracted to aspects of Jewish worship and life, but most Jews were content to observe their traditional customs and forms of worship themselves, and to let pagans do whatever pagans chose to do. This view has been argued convincingly by a number of recent scholars, including ancient historian Martin Goodman, who, on the basis of a thorough examination of every significant piece of ancient pagan and Jewish evidence, has concluded that the evangelizing mission of the Christian Church was unparalleled and unprecedented. Such a proselytizing mission was a shocking novelty in the ancient world. This mission of evangelism, as we will see, became a standard feature of the Christian movement, and eventually, for many Christians, a contest for converts. But significantly, as Goodman explains, for most of the period before Constantine's conversion, such Christians will have been running in a race of whose existence most of the other competitors were unaware. If the concerted attempt to win converts was not a standard feature of ancient religion, even Judaism, why did Christianity become missionary? Even though our ancient sources provide us with no firm answer, some informed intuition would suggest that surely it had to do with the nature of the Christian message. Christians, as early as Paul, the first to undertake a worldwide mission, maintained that Christ died because it was God's plan to bring salvation to the world. Those who did not experience the salvation were lost, doomed to punishment. As an apocalyptic Jew, Paul, and then his converts, insisted God was soon to enter into judgment with this world. A cataclysmic act of destruction was to occur. Those who were in Christ would be spared the onslaught and be brought into God's eternal kingdom. Those who were not would be destroyed. Some Christians insisted the coming cataclysm was not simply an annihilation in which a person would cease to exist. It was to entail ongoing punishment, eternal torment. At the same time, Christianity prided itself as a religion of love. Jesus was remembered as one who taught his followers to love God above all things, but also, next, to love their neighbors as themselves. By neighbor, he did not simply mean the person next door. Everyone is a neighbor. Even an enemy is a neighbor. Christians were to love everyone in the world, even those who detested, opposed, and persecuted them. If God commands his people to love others and consequently to act in ways that will benefit them, and if others are destined to the coming divine judgment unless they turn to God in repentance and begin to worship him alone, there is only one clear conclusion. Christians need to urge others to adopt their religion. It is the only way these others will be saved, the only way they can escape eternal punishment. It is therefore the only way a Christian can really show love for the other. Christians then, starting at least with Paul, came to be missionary, convinced they had to convert the world. Goodman maintains it was Paul himself who came up with the idea. He was the innovator, the single apostle, who invented the whole idea of a systematic conversion of the world, area by geographical area. At the same time, this is what makes it so striking and unexpected that, outside of Paul's work itself, we do not know of any organized Christian missionary work, not just for the first century, but for any century prior to the conversion of most of the empire. As McMullen has succinctly put it, after St. Paul, the church had no mission. That may be hard to believe, but in fact, if you were to count every Christian missionary about whom even a single story is told, from the period after the New Testament up through the first four centuries, you would not need all the digits on one hand. There is Gregory, the wonder worker, who worked not worldwide but in a small area of 3rd century Pontus, a province in what is now northern Turkey. Martin of Tours, a 4th century bishop who converted pagans in his own city of Tours in France. And Porphyry, a late 4th century bishop who closed pagan temples in Gaza and converted their devotees. We are not talking about armies of volunteers knocking on doors. We know of three, all in a different isolated region. And as we will see, even the stories told of them are highly legendary. If Christians did not convert others through organized missionary efforts, how did they do it? The answer is simple. It was not by public preaching or door-to-door canvassing of strangers. They used their everyday social networks and converted people simply by word of mouth. Social networks are all the human connections we have by virtue of the fact that each of us is a living, breathing human being who has a life. We have family, we have friends, we have neighbors, we know people at work, we see acquaintances on the street, at the store, and at sporting events. We belong to clubs and organizations. We participate in the life of our communities. In short, we have numerous connections in numerous ways with numerous people. The people you know from different points of contact often know many other people you also know, and they know people you do not know. Those people you do not know may know some people you know and certainly others you do not. Social networks all overlap, but they are never the same from one person to the next. The community comprises everyone networked into it in a wide range of ways. This was true in the ancient world as well. Christians did not associate only with Christians. In the early centuries, most of the people Christians would have known would have been non-Christians. The way Christianity spread was principally through these networks. A Christian woman talks about her newfound faith to a close friend. She tells the stories she has heard, stories about Jesus and about his followers. She also tells stories about her own life, how she has been helped after prayer to the Christian God. After a while, this other person expresses genuine interest. Over time, she considers joining the church herself. When she does so, that opens up more possibilities of sharing the good news, because she too has friends. And family, neighbors, and people she sees in all sorts of contexts, the woman converts. Over time, she converts her husband. He insists the entire family, children, servants, slaves, follow the Christian religion. 3 years later, he ends up converting a business associate. That one requires his family as well to adopt the Christian faith. One of his teenage daughters eventually not only goes through the religious motions that her father requires, for example, saying prayers and going to the weekly church meeting, but becomes deeply committed. She converts her best friend, who converts her mother, who converts her husband, and then the next-door neighbor. And so it goes, year after year after year. One reason Christianity grows is that it is the only religion like this. The others are not missionary, and they are not exclusive. These two features make Christianity unlike anything else on offer. The people who become Christian are turning their backs on their pagan pasts, their pagan customs, and their pagan gods. That means that virtually every new Christian is also an ex-pagan. Every new addition to the church means one less adherent to the old, traditional religions. As Christianity grows, it is destroying paganism in its wake. Christian exclusivism. One way to understand Christian exclusivity is to think about the Christian's unusual approach to choice. Of course, everyone in the ancient world had to choose how to live, what to think, how to behave, and how to worship. In fact, pagan religions in recent scholarship have been portrayed as a kind of marketplace, where shoppers would choose among competing options. Just as you might choose to buy a fish, so you could choose a cult to follow. And at the market, you might buy not only a fish, but also some fruit, some grains, and some vegetables. At every point, you make a choice. So too with religion. You can choose which cults to belong to and how often or rigorously to observe them. For pagan religions, the cults you followed normally would not have provided a distinctive identity marker. If someone asked you how you identified yourself, you would not have said, "I'm a worshiper of Apollo," any more than you would have said, "I'm a consumer of sea bass." You might indeed have worshipped Apollo on occasion, just as you might have sometimes eaten sea bass, but that was not how you identified yourself. In no small measure, that was because your decision for Apollo and sea bass was just one of the many decisions you made all the time with respect to cult and cuisine. Christianity was different. The Christian God was not normally chosen as one of the gods to be worshipped. The choice in this case was exclusive. The choice specifically for one thing was the choice against everything else. It was eating sea bass and nothing but sea bass. And to most pagan minds, it probably seemed just as odd. Scholars have long noted this distinctive feature of Christianity, especially since the days of Arthur Darby Nock, whose book Conversion is one of the true classics in the field. Nock argued that the principal difference between pagan religions and Christianity was the difference between adhesion and conversion. Within paganism, one always had the possibility of adopting a new set of religious practices, but that simply meant adhering to it. There was no sense that a person who turned to a new cult had to turn away from another. That sense of completely turning to a new thing and in so doing leaving behind the old is what Nock meant by conversion. Nock was operating with an older sense of what conversion entailed, as the complete, heartfelt, emotional commitment to the new thing, the view I critiqued earlier in the chapter. All the same, Nock deeply understood that what traditional Christianity expected of a new follower had no precise parallel in paganism. He did acknowledge that something comparable to the concept of conversion could be found in the philosophical traditions of antiquity. At least some of the philosophical traditions were seen to be mutually exclusive. An Epicurean philosopher was not also a Stoic. A cynic was not a peripatetic. These were not airtight categories, and there certainly were philosophically oriented people who borrowed from one school of thought or another. But, strictly speaking, a real disciple of Aristotle was not a follower of Epicurus. So Christianity was a bit like that. One difference is that philosophical schools were not religious cults, even if they did discuss the divine and human's relationship with it. There were also, however, rare instances in which followers of one divine being or another expressed deep and virtually exclusive devotion. No example is better known or more fully exploited by Nock than the devotion to the goddess Isis found in a popular work of Roman fiction, The Golden Ass, written by Apuleius, a North African author of the 2nd century CE. Exploring this account can indeed help us understand the contrasts between pagan adherence and Christian conversion. A pagan parallel to Christian exclusivity, the Golden Ass. The Golden Ass is a hilarious tale filled with joyous and rather raucous sex, nocturnal magical rites, murderous plots, wild escapades, narrow escapes, and as it turns out, deeply felt religious experiences. As the title indicates, it is about an ass, or rather about a man who becomes an ass. The main character is named Lucius. On a journey to a new city, Lucius is hosted by a man whose wife is a witch, and Lucius is fascinated. After seducing the housemaid, Fotis, Lucius convinces her to allow him to watch her mistress practice her magical craft. Looking through a chink in the door, he sees the woman anoint herself with a magical potion to be transformed into an owl before flying off into the night. Desperate to obtain such power, Lucius urges Fotis to retrieve the ointment for him. She enters her mistress's chamber and snatches the jar, but rather unfortunately for Lucius, but luckily for the plot, she grabs the wrong one. When Lucius applies the ointment, he turns not into a noble owl, but into a ridiculous ass, with his human mind intact but no human physical abilities. He could do nothing but bemoan his fate by braying loudly. Fotis, trained in the ways of her mistress, knows what Lucius the ass must do to be restored to his human self. He needs simply to eat some roses. Before any can be found, in the dead of night, robbers break into the house, despoil its contents, steal the ass Lucius, load him with plunder, and drive him off to their stronghold. The rest of the long tale narrates Lucius's misadventures as a man trapped in a beast's body, being handed over from one set of owners to another. Overworked, beaten, manhandled, and generally abused, though occasionally treated well. As part of the narrative, he is often privy to intriguing stories told by owners within hearing distance, all while desperately trying to locate a bunch of roses to consume, always to no avail. The ribald and rowdy story takes an unexpected turn at the end. Lucius the ass has a deep religious experience that changes not only his outer life, literally as he becomes a man once more, but even more his inner person. He becomes a devotee of the Egyptian goddess Isis. By book 11, Lucius is more than fed up with his asinine existence. He escapes his latest masters, manages to find a quiet place on the seashore, and falls asleep, only to awaken to see the moon rise over the ocean. He knows that the moon was the primal goddess of supreme sway, so he immerses his head 7 times in the water as a ritual act and invokes her, acknowledging that she might be any one of a number of divine beings, the goddess Ceres, Venus, Diana, or Proserpina. He ends his catalog of petitionary options by covering every possibility, or by whatever name and by whatever rites, and in whatever form it is permitted to invoke you. Then he has an epiphany. The goddess appears to him. She informs him that she is the ultimate divine being. I, the natural mother of all life, the mistress of the elements, the first child of time, the supreme divinity, the queen of those in hell, the first among those in heaven, the uniform manifestation of all the gods and goddesses, I who govern by my nod the crests of light in the sky, the purifying wafts of the ocean and the lamentable silences of hell. She goes on to indicate that various peoples have called her various things, but that her true name is Queen Isis. Isis promises to bring Lucius salvation, that is, to deliver him from his lowly, beastly existence. Furthermore, she will enable him to worship her even after his mortal death. But there is a condition. When she bestows her blessings upon him, he must be utterly devoted to her. All the remaining days of your life must be dedicated to me, and nothing can release you from this service but death. You should devote your life to her, who redeems you back into humanity. Isis is true to her word. She instructs Lucius that the next day, at a festival in her honor, he will find a priest bearing a bouquet of roses, which he will be able to consume to return to his human shape. He does so, and it happens. The rest of the book narrates how Lucius then devotes himself to the worship of the goddess. He goes through a prolonged and rather difficult period of preparation, and then is initiated into her mysteries. The author cannot tell us exactly what is said during the ceremony, or exactly what happens. He is, after all, describing a mystery, and he is not about to explain what actually happened in any detail. And so his account is both rapturous and frustratingly elusive. What is clear is that Lucius experiences the most glorious moment of his mortal existence, a kind of new birth, and he dedicates his life to serving Isis. He later learns, however, that he has not reached the pinnacle of devotion. There is a higher level, a ceremonial induction into the mysteries of the divine husband of Isis, the father of the gods, unconquerable Osiris. Lucius is surprised, for I had thought myself fully initiated already. But no, Osiris is the greater god, and a new initiation is necessary. In part, Lucius is dismayed, because participating in these initiations is expensive. But he goes through with it. Sometime later, he learns that a third initiation is necessary. He starts wondering if this is a scam, but he decides to calm his suspicions. Afterward, he realizes that, in fact, all is well. At length, after the lapse of a few days, the Lord Osiris, the most powerful of the great gods, the highest of the greater, the greatest of the highest, and ruler of the greatest, appeared to me in the night, now no longer disguised, by deigning to speak to me in his own person and with his own divine voice. And soon the book ends. As Nock recognized, there are indeed numerous parallels between what happened to the fictional character Lucius in his devotion to Isis and the Golden Ass, and what happened to actual pagans who became Christian. Lucius recognizes Isis as the greatest of divine beings, one who is worshipped in heaven, on earth and under the earth. In exchange for his devotion, she transforms his life. He is born again. In a sense, he becomes fully human, literally. Moreover, he is promised a life after death. In exchange, she demands a complete commitment. He is initiated into her cult, and he lives his life in adoration of her. That does indeed sound very much like what happened to converts who joined the Christian community, recognizing the God of the Christians as the one ruler over all who was more powerful than all beings in heaven and earth, who could bring new life to one who was born again, not to mention life after death, in exchange for absolute devotion. But there is a very real and tangible difference. Lucius never had to think or act as if Isis were in fact the only divine being. On the contrary, she was superior to all others. As it turned out, not even that was right. There was one greater, Osiris. Were there yet others even greater? The author never says. When Lucius turned to Isis, he did not stop being a pagan who recognized the divinity of other divine beings, nor did he make any commitment to worship her alone. His was not an exclusive devotion. It was simply a particularly intense devotion. The advantages of exclusivity. And so, Christianity was the only evangelistic religion that we know of in antiquity, and along with Judaism, it was also the only one that was exclusive. That combination of evangelism and exclusion proved to be decisive for the triumph of Christianity. If it had been evangelistic but not exclusive, it may well have gained adherents, but paganism would have remained unaffected. Pagans would simply have begun to worship Christ along with whatever other gods they chose. Jupiter, Apollo, Diana, Mithras, Isis, take your pick. If, on the other hand, it had been exclusive but not evangelistic, Christianity, like Judaism, would have simply been an isolated and marginal religion without masses of adherents. But it gained a massive following, not at first, but over time, progressively adding to its ranks year after year, decade after decade. As it grew, paganism necessarily shrank. Unlike any religion known to the human race at the time, Christianity thrived by killing off its opposition. No one has seen that better or argued it more convincingly than Roman social historian Ramsay MacMullan. MacMullan explains with a hypothetical example that I will modify slightly. Suppose two persons were each promoting a new cult, one the worship of Asclepius and the other the worship of Jesus. A crowd of 100 pagan polytheists gathers to hear each devotee extol the glories of his god. In the end, the two prove to be equally successful. 50 of the crowd decide now to worship Asclepius, and 50 others decide to worship the Christian god. What happens to the overall relationship of inclusive paganism and exclusive Christianity? If our two hypothetical speakers are equally persuasive, paganism has lost 50 worshipers and gained no one, whereas Christianity has gained 50 worshipers and lost no one. Christianity is destroying the pagan religions in its wake. This example, of course, is completely hypothetical and unlikely for all sorts of reasons. We do not know of pagan evangelists working a crowd. And even though Christianity was evangelistic, we don't know of public speeches aimed at conversion outside of the book of Acts in the New Testament, and later comparably legendary accounts. Moreover, it does not appear that there ever were massive on-the-spot conversions to Christianity, a point on which I strongly disagree with Professor McMullen. Christianity grew by one-on-one discourse, as a person would convince a family member, friend, or acquaintance, who would convince another, who would convince another. How these people proved convincing will be the subject of the next chapter. For now, the point is that it is highly unlikely that anyone convinced 50 people at one time, let alone on the spot on the basis of a single public talk. But the point still holds. Christianity necessarily destroyed the other religions as it grew, and it was the only religion in the empire doing so. As the church grew, the pagan world shrank until, after a couple of centuries, pagans realized they had a problem on their hands. Christianity as an all-encompassing religion. One other feature of Christianity that made it different from all the pagan religions throughout the empire is that it encompassed numerous aspects of life that had always been kept distinct. Adopting the Christian religion did not mean simply participating in cultic activities, as was the case for other religions, whether imperial cults, civic cults, or family cults. For these pagan religions, the cultic acts were the religion. Cultic acts for Christianity, however, such as baptism, communion meals, prayers, hymns, and so on, were certainly important aspects of the religion, but they were only some of the aspects. Christianity also entailed an ethical code, a way of thinking about the divine, and a set of stories about divine intervention in the past. In the words of a scholar of ancient Rome, James Reeves, Christianity was a totalizing discourse. That is, it involved a totality of a person's life. It was all-encompassing. As a corollary, since Christians conceptualized their religion as a coherent system, they began thinking that everything outside their religion was a competing coherent system. Thus, relatively early in their history, Christians declared, there were three kinds of persons, Christian, Jewish, and pagan. Being a pagan meant being something. Paganism became an entity, granted its own ism. Everything not Jewish or Christian cohered together, even if there were hundreds, even thousands of manifestations of this one thing with enormous differences among them. That coherent whole was the rest of the world. Because paganism was now seen as a recognizable thing standing as a competing force against Christianity, even though for most of the first 300 years no one on the other side realized they were in a competition, it could be appraised, evaluated, and condemned. It could be contrasted with Christianity and judged to be deficient in everything that it practiced, believed, and taught. Pagans could be portrayed as unethical, as believing foolish things, as engaging in meaningless, or worse, demonic, acts of worship. Comprising such features, paganism could be attacked, and over time it was attacked, successfully. Reasons for the Christian success, in sum. A number of listeners will have realized that I have been speaking in broadly general, even generalizing terms about Christians and Christianity, as if the early Christian movement were one thing, not lots of different things. The reality, as we know so well, is that Christianity was an amazingly diverse phenomenon throughout the first four Christian centuries, with different Christians advocating an enormous range of beliefs and engaging in strikingly different practices. This has been the subject of a large number of books in modern times, especially over the past 40 years. If so, how can we make such broad generalizations as Christianity was exclusive or Christianity was evangelistic? I have made these statements fully knowing that Christianity encompassed a terrifically divergent set of beliefs and practices. There certainly were Christians, arguably the majority of them, who were not interested in evangelizing their next-door neighbors. And there were almost certainly large numbers of Christians who refused, either in their minds and hearts or in their daily lives, to be committed fully and exclusively to the Christian God alone. In my view, all of that goes without saying. But I need to say it anyway, in part because in the long run, I do not think that it matters for the case I'm trying to make. For the argument I have been advancing, it is not important whether Christianity is reduced to some kind of essential entity that is necessarily evangelistic and exclusive. What matters is that broad swaths of it demonstrably were. That is the kind of Christianity that in the end became dominant in the empire. I would like to make two concluding points about this eventually dominant form of Christianity. The first is that we know about it from the majority of written sources that have come down to us, and these documents represent idealizations of later Christian leaders. This is the way the elite, highly educated Christian writers of the early centuries who produced our texts wanted to portray Christianity, and possibly how they fervently wanted Christianity to be. This means these views represent the perspectives of the cultured leaders of the church. But it also means they were the views of those who were in power. That is a point to consider deeply. In my judgment, it would make no sense to think that the official line taken by leaders of the church were completely unrelated to the views held by numbers of average church people who possibly didn't think much about such things on their own. These are the views they were taught by those in power. And even if they are idealizations, they would represent idealizations held by other Christians as well, not simply by the elite authors whose works have come down to us. Again, for my purposes, it would not matter if everyone held these views as long as some did, and probably a significant number of Christians did. My second point is that the distinctive features of this idealized Christianity that I have been presenting, that it was evangelistic, exclusive, and totalizing, can almost certainly be attributed to a number of the Christian groups of the first four centuries, not simply the one that became dominant. It is true that most of our surviving writings come down to us from sources that scholars call Orthodox and Proto-Orthodox. The term Orthodox refers to the form of Christian belief and practice that came to be dominant in the fourth century after Christianity began to expand and grow significantly. Proto-Orthodox refers to the similar form of Christianity that was held by forerunners of the Orthodox party in the years before its views came to dominate. In those years of predominance, there were varieties of Christian belief, but even some of these non-Orthodox groups, call them heresies, were evangelistic and invested in converting Jews and pagans into their fold. Most of the converts into the Proto-Orthodox tradition, as well as most of the heretical traditions, came not from Jewish communities, but from the ranks of the pagans. With such potential converts, Christians of different sorts made some common cause. They agreed with a growing number of pagans that ultimately there is one divine being above and beyond all others. For these Christians, this was not an unknown god, or one of the Roman pantheon, or simply the greatest god, Theos Hepsistos. It was the God of Israel, who had become the God of the Christians. These Christians also agreed with pagans that one of the chief reasons to revere this God was that he could provide numerous benefits to those who acknowledged his divinity and properly worshipped him. Divine benefactions had always been at the core of pagan religious devotion, as they were at the core of Christianity. What made these Christians different from those who adhered to traditional pagan religions was their concern and, for at least some of them, their passion to convert others to the worship of their God. Their insistence that anyone who did so needed to turn away from the gods they had always worshipped, and their view that true devotion to God involved not just ritual acts, but also ethical behavior and proper doctrinal understanding of who this God was. This was the form of Christianity proclaimed by the first known missionary to the pagans, the Apostle Paul. It was the message proclaimed by our literate, elite, cultured Christian writers from the Proto-Orthodox tradition. It was a message that later Orthodox writers of the 4th century insisted upon with unusual vehemence, and it is the message that eventually overtook the religious world of Roman antiquity. One dominant question, though, is why anyone found the message convincing. Why were pagans persuaded to give up everything they had ever thought, change everything they had ever practiced, abandon all the gods they had ever worshipped, in order to join the Christian community and worship only the God of the Christians? Chapter 5. Miraculous Incentives for Conversion. We have already seen that the church did not spread through a well-thought-out and highly organized missionary endeavor, a first-century parallel to British and American missions to deepest, darkest Africa and other heathen places in the 19th century. It spread by word of mouth, from one person to another, all deeply connected in their daily lives to social networks through which news could circulate and views could air. One place to start in considering the persuasiveness of the Christians is with the audience they were addressing, the pagan reservoir from which they were drawing most of their converts. We wish we knew who these people were. It would especially help if we had some disinterested sources of information, but we do not. For the first 150 years of the Church, virtually all our evidence comes from Christian accounts, which are obviously slanted in a particular direction and often make unverifiable claims about the masses adopting this new faith. The first extensive discussion of the Christian movement from a non-Christian source, also not disinterested, of course, comes from the end of the 170s. We do not have this source as a standalone document. It is a book quoted instead by a Christian author, the great theologian Origen of Alexandria, who cited it precisely in order to refute it. The book had been written by an otherwise unknown pagan intellectual named Celsus. Celsus's work was called The True Word. In it, he assails Christianity as a foolish and dangerous religion that lacks all academic credentials and poses ominous problems, particularly because it leads people astray from traditional religions. Celsus's attack was direct and incisive. He had read the Christian Gospels, and with rapier-like wit and clear-headed analysis tried to tear them to shreds, along with the Jesus they worshipped. Origen had his hands full in writing a refutation some 6 decades later. Much could be said about Celsus's critique of the Christian faith, but for our purposes here, one point he makes is particularly trenchant. He argues, with obvious exaggeration, that Christianity is a religion of ignoramuses who are too thick to recognize either religious truth or valid argument. Christian proponents work especially hard to convert the foolish and the gullible. Here's what Celsus says in a rather amusing but mocking tone, a statement worth quoting at length. Wherever one finds a crowd of adolescent boys or a bunch of slaves or a company of fools, there will the Christian teachers be also, showing off their fine new philosophy. In private houses, one can see wool workers, cobblers, laundry workers, and the most illiterate country bumpkins, who would not venture to voice their opinions in front of their intellectual betters. But let them get hold of children in private houses, let them find some gullible wives, and you will hear some preposterous statements. You will hear them say, for instance, that they should not pay any attention to their fathers or teachers, but must obey them. They say that their elders and teachers are fools, and are in reality very bad men who like to voice their silly opinions. Now if, as they are speaking thus to the children, they happen to see a school teacher coming along, some intelligent person, or even the father of one of the children, these Christians flee in all directions. These Christians also tell the children that they should leave their fathers and teachers and follow the women and the little chums to the wool dresser's shop, or the cobbler's, or to the washerwoman's shop, so that they might learn how to be perfect. And by this logic, they have persuaded many to join them. There's obviously a lot of elitist snobbery going on here, but there may be some truth as well. We have very little evidence to suggest that serious intellectuals converted to the Christian faith between the time of Paul and the mid-second century. Most converts would have been lower class and uneducated. This was certainly true in Paul's own day. In a letter to one of his largest congregations, he explicitly reminds the Corinthians about their own constituency. Consider your calling, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards, not many of you were powerful, not many of you were born to nobility. But God chose the foolish in the world to put to shame the wise. God chose the weak in the world to put to shame the strong. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. Some scholars over the past 30 years have stressed that since Paul indicates not many of the Corinthian Christians were wise, powerful, or of the nobility, surely some of them must have been. That is probably true, but Paul's entire point is that the vast majority of his converts were uneducated, powerless, and lower class. Nothing in our early Christian sources suggests things had changed much in the century between Paul and Celsus. On the contrary, it is striking that when Celsus claims that the ignorant lower classes, either literally or figuratively children, were particularly attracted to Christianity, Origen does not defend the faith by disagreeing. In his view, the fact that Christianity could be so successful despite its lack of intellectual force and impact on the highly educated classes shows that God must be behind the movement. It is not gaining converts because of its obvious intellectual superiority. The early 4th century defender of the faith, Lactantius, also indicates that most Christians were uneducated and quote-unquote foolish. Divine Institutes 5, 1-2. Celsus also mocks Christianity for being a religion not just of children, but also of gullible women. He clearly means this is a slur. It may simply represent a standard misogynistic charge leveled against a despised social group. But there are other indications that, for some time, the Christian faith drew more women than men into the fold. One piece of hard evidence comes somewhat later. As we will see, in 303 CE, the Emperor Diocletian inaugurated an empire-wide persecution. We are fortunate to have a report of personal belongings confiscated at the time from a church in the town of Sirte, North Africa. 16 men's tunics, but 38 veils, 82 women's tunics, and 47 pairs of female slippers. This datum is slight, but it has led one historian, Robin Lane Fox, to claim, though probably on too thin a thread of evidence, that it is highly likely that women were a clear majority in the churches of the 3rd century. By the middle of the 2nd century, one does start seeing isolated intellectuals convert to the faith. Justin in Rome, Tertullian in North Africa, Origen himself in Alexandria. These are clear exceptions to the rule. At the same time, it cannot be emphasized enough that most people in the Roman world by far were lower class and uneducated, so it cannot come as a surprise that most Christians were. Still, the church may have had more than its fair share. Among other things, this suggests that most converts were not drawn in by the writings of the Christian literary elite or through public debates with well-educated proponents of the faith. Sophisticated argument was almost certainly not the principal engine of conversion. There have been numerous attempts over the years to determine exactly what, then, was driving the Christian success. I do not need to enumerate all the options. It may be useful, however, to begin by considering two of the more intriguing but ultimately implausible ones. The attractions of the Christian community. It is often thought and widely claimed that one of the main reasons pagans converted to Christianity was because of the inherent attractiveness of the church community. Pagan civic cults did not involve much community. They did entail ceremonies performed in public in the presence of others, but there were no weekly community meetings, opportunities for fellowship or planned times of discussion, reflection, and sharing of concerns. That was different within Christianity. Much like the Jewish synagogues out of which they grew, Christian churches entailed regularly scheduled weekly meetings. Converting to Christianity was not an isolated individualistic affair, a matter of private spirituality. It meant joining the church. The church was not a place. There were no buildings for Christian gatherings until the middle of the 3rd century, so far as we know. Prior to that, and probably for a good while afterward, most churches met in private homes and in outdoor areas such as cemeteries. Rather than being a place, the church was a community, a tightly knit community, a community as tightly knit as the nuclear family. In fact, Christians were often encouraged to replace their families with the members of their new community. The founder, or leader of the church, was a father. Fellow believers were brothers and sisters in one big family. Moreover, these were self-consciously communities of mutual love and respect. They provided material support for their needy members. They provided moral support for everyone who came. Such, at least, were the claims of Christians who wrote about the church. Whether all this was entirely true is another question, but numerous scholars have maintained that the obvious attractions of this kind of community would have drawn in outsiders eager to join for the enormous social benefits. Classical historian E.R. Dodds once claimed that the nature of the Christian community was a major cause, perhaps the single cause, of the spread of Christianity. Support for this view might seem to come from a comment by the late 4th century emperor Julian, known to history as Julian the Apostate, since he abandoned his Christian faith to adopt and promote traditional pagan religions. Julian was the only pagan emperor after Constantine. He ruled for 19 months, from 361 to 363 CE. He was, in fact, Constantine's nephew and had been raised in the church, but he rebelled upon taking office and was intent to reconvert the empire to paganism, as we will see more fully in Chapter 9. In one of his letters, Julian laments the success of the Christian church and attributes it to the benefactions that Christians bestowed on others. Expressing his wish that pagan religions could follow the Christian example of community and communal giving. In this citation, he refers to Christians both as atheists, since they do not revere the gods, and Galileans. Why do we not observe that it is their benevolence to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness of their lives that had done most to increase atheism? It is disgraceful that, when no Jew ever has to beg, and the impious Galileans support not only their own poor but ours as well, everyone can see that our people lack aid from us. Julian, Letter 22. And so, it has been argued, Christian communal life ultimately attracted adherents. There are, however, difficulties with this view. For one thing, as a young man, Julian himself had been actively involved in the church and so knew of its workings from the inside. His was not an outsider's report. He may well have believed that charity drew people in, but it is striking that the advantages of church membership are never mentioned as a reason for conversion by any Christian on record. As Adolf von Harnack concedes, based on an exhaustive evaluation of all our literary sources, we know of no cases in which Christians desired to win, or actually did win, adherents by means of the charities which they dispensed. That is not to say that benefits did not accrue to those who came into the church. On the contrary, there is good reason to suspect that numerous people found the Christian church very gratifying indeed, in no small measure for the social, emotional, physical, and intellectual benefits it bestowed. But there is a difference between benefits that might entice people to join the community in the first place and benefits that might encourage them to remain once they are there. Bringing someone in is not the same as keeping them in. The early Christian churches were closed communities. Outsiders were not allowed to join in worship services. They did not know the inner workings of the church or the full advantages of what it had to offer. Indeed, as we will see later, stories about what happened within Christian communities could be considerably repugnant rather than attractive. In short, we have little evidence to suggest that people widely, if at all, join the church because of the communal benefits they would receive. Something else probably made the Christian religion attractive. Superior health care. One benefit of joining the church, which had been recently touted as particularly important for Christian growth, was the availability of better health care. This was one of the many controversial proposals set forth by sociologist Rodney Stark in his popular discussion, The Rise of Christianity, A Sociologist Reconsiders History, and was the thesis behind a more extensive treatment by Hector Avalos, Healthcare and the Rise of Christianity. Despite Avalos's in-depth discussion of how early Christians organized, managed, and implemented healthcare, he never mounts an argument to show how the Christian healthcare system attracted converts or led to church growth. Stark, on the other hand, applies his sociological training to the question and makes some intriguing suggestions. He points out that epidemics swept through the Roman world on more than one occasion during the period that Christianity was gaining members. The terrible plague that ravaged the empire during the reign of Marcus Aurelius killed, Stark avers, between a quarter and a third of the entire population of the empire. The emperor himself was one of the fatalities. Stark notes that Christian sources celebrate the eagerness of Christians to minister to the sick in times of illness. Stark claims this was unlike the pagans who, as a rule, simply let the sick fend for themselves. He goes on to point to studies that indicate that even without access to modern medicine, simple nursing, caring for someone who is ill, can have a drastic effect on survival rates. Stark concludes that Christians emerged from epidemics far more intact as a population group than pagans, so their relative numbers grew through nothing more than the decision to nurse the sick. This is an intriguing perspective, but it has not proved widely persuasive for several reasons. For one thing, Stark unrealistically and uncritically assumes that when Christian sources praise Christians and malign pagans for their healthcare practices, they are giving factual information. For him, a Christian author is simply stating historical reality when he praises fellow Christians for acts of love far superior to anything found elsewhere, and maligns outsiders for neglecting even their dying family members. Historians of early Christianity are never this sanguine when it comes to our sources. One always needs to consider their obvious biases. Beyond that, there is a fairly obvious reason for doubting that Christian nursing practices in times of epidemic led to growth in the church. If our sources are indeed to be trusted that Christians tended to the sick more often than pagans did, that would surely also mean that Christians were more often infected. As it turns out, early Christian texts bemoan precisely this fact. Christians frequently died because they acquired the diseases they were trying to heal. This is a point